Welcome to CyberSquid Radio, an up-and-coming podcast where we discuss the latest science news and science-related pop culture we think matters most to you. I'm Jeff Stevenson, a science communicator based here in Toledo, Ohio.
And I'm Logan Shear, a chef and science enthusiast based in Denver, Colorado. Today, we sit down with Nancy Atkinson. In her newest book, she tells the stories of the people behind NASA's unmanned space exploration projects.
Should we send robots or humans to space?
What happens at NASA behind the scenes?
Who are the people running unmanned missions?
All that and more on this week's episode of CyberSquid Radio.
I know what you mean when you say you can't explain. I know you gotta run, that's the way you play the game.
Nancy Atkinson is a lifetime science journalist. She has witnessed countless mission launches and has a personal relationship with the engineers and scientists at NASA. She is a contributing editor for Universe Today and has recently published a book entitled Incredible Stories from Space, a behind-the-scenes look at the missions changing our view of the cosmos. This book has some amazing insights on the people behind all of your favorite NASA missions. She joins us today from her home in Minnesota. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, both your career, personal hobbies, anything you enjoy?
All right. Well, I've been writing for Universe Today for, probably 13, 14 years now. So I've been part of the space exploration reporting scene for quite a while. And it's been nothing but fun. It's been so enjoyable to be able to talk to so many amazing people and, you know, have the chance to tour a few of the different NASA centers and Jet Propulsion Laboratory, see some rocket launches. It's been a lot of fun. So,
what rocket launches did you see?
I got to go see two space shuttle launches. And also I saw the Solar Dynamics Observatory and one of the GOES satellites. So, yeah.
Okay. I'm unfamiliar with the GOES. What's that say
it's
for?
It's a Earth-observing satellite.
Okay. Weather patterns?
Yeah, a lot of weather patterns. Weather searching, whatever. And so it's, yeah. There's, I think that the one that I saw was GOES. GOES P, which is a horrible name, but now they're using numbers. So I think they're up to GOES. They used to use letters, and then once they got to GOES P, it was like, okay, we have to use numbers now. So I think
that's a terrible
but they
decision.
They still went with P. They went with P, and then decided now's the time to switch to numbers.
How did the media office not catch this?
It's like Bart Simpson's naming spacecrafts.
I think they're up to like GOES 16 now. So it's been a great series of satellites. So, yeah.
One of my biggest regrets is my family would go down to Florida for Christmas and we'd do a little vacation and just got us out of the cold weather of Ohio. And my dad wanted to go see the space shuttle launch. This was probably in 1998, 97. And it would have required us to wake up at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, drive down to the Kennedy Space Center and watch this thing go up at 8, 9 in the morning. And my family, we decided, you know what, we just don't really feel like getting up at 2:30 in the morning, 3 a.m. and doing this whole drive. But looking back, I really wish that I could have gotten that experience as a child to go see that go up.
Oh yeah, it's an amazing experience. Seeing a launch is just incredible. The first space shuttle launch that I saw was a night launch.
Oh, wow.
And it was just spectacular. Wow. You know, and you're standing there as a journalist. I was able to be the closest that anybody can be, which is like 3 miles away.
Okay.
And so you hear you can see the engines ignite, and about 20 seconds later, the sound comes across the water.
Right.
And the sound was so amazing. I mean, my pants legs were vibrating because of the sound waves. And I heard an astronaut describe it as the air just isn't big enough for the sound. And that's the best description that, you know, there's no other way to describe it.
Right.
It's an amazing experience. So, yeah. And anybody, if you have a chance to see a launch, do it, because it's really incredible.
It's definitely on my bucket list.
And this is just part of your job. Like, you got to go to work today and see that space launch. Like, you got to see that shuttle launch. This is part of your everyday Monday blues, huh?
Yeah. So I actually went down and spent 2 months down at Kennedy Space Center because, it was getting close to the end of the space shuttle, missions. And I hadn't seen a launch, and I was like, okay, I just want to go see a couple of launches. And I looked at the calendar, and I could see in a 2 month span, I could see 2 space shuttle launches plus 2, robotic mission launches. And so it was like, okay, I'm just going down there and staying. But I got to see so many other things too. I got to do, kind of behind the scenes tours of the International Space Station processing. Cargo ship everything has to be approved and processed in order to go up there. So I got to see those kind of behind the scenes things. Got to stand directly on the launch pad, and it was as they got closer to the end of the space shuttle program, they were doing things for the journalists that they normally didn't do. So like, I was in this van of journalists, and they didn't tell us that they were going to bring us up to the launch pad. Normally you have to stand behind the gate. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden the gate opened, and we just drove right up onto the launch pad right underneath Space Shuttle Discovery.
Oh, and really? So it was mounted?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, there was a space shuttle there. So,
just makes you feel like an ant.
You know, the veteran journalists that I was with, they were just like, their eyes got wide, and I looked over at them, and they said, "Don't say anything. Just go with it.
Play cool."
So, your job as a contributing editor and a space exploration writer in general is to get people excited on the subject of space exploration. But where does your enthusiasm stem from in this topic? Like, how did you get started in this? And maybe even younger than that.
Yeah. Well, I think I've always been interested in space exploration, and it started when I was really young. I am old enough now that I can that I remember watching the Apollo missions to the moon. So I don't remember very much. I just remember sitting on the floor with my sister, we were glued to the television set, and we watched these missions from, start to finish. That we just, I was just captivated by that. And then, in our weekly reader in school, I got the pictures back from the Voyager mission to explore the outer solar system. And I just have always been captivated by, exploration and trying to find out what's out there, that kind of thing. So just have always been interested and have kept up with space exploration. Unfortunately, I wasn't all that good in science in school, but but I always wanted to be a writer too. And finally it was like, I could write about space.
That's actually really encouraging that you can have a love for science, not necessarily be super engrossed into the Excel data collection that is doing science, which is oftentimes tedious, but you can almost be like a science groupie, if you would,
Yeah, the cheerleader, the ambassador.
Yeah, I would say that's what I am. And for me to really understand the science or technology behind something, I have to bring it down to kind of the least common denominator, make it really easy to understand. And that's what a lot of people have told me is that, I could understand this the way you explained it, kind of thing. So that's kind of what I...
That makes a lot of sense to us, because I think sometimes Logan and I have encountered this before where we're re-listening to something we've explained and it's like, we spent weeks reading about this and now we started talking halfway through. And it really sometimes does take someone to kind of give you that outside perspective to really get new people involved and really get these topics, which are oftentimes really complicated, to be understandable to the layperson.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that's been kind of scientists have been accused of not being able to explain their science very well in an easy to understand way. And
Well, Nancy, I have to say, yeah, I've been reading your book this past week, and you definitely do a good job of not necessarily explaining for these scientists and engineers, but putting them in the best light that they're explaining their work in a more readable manner.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was writing the book was just a really fun experience because I got to talk to so many different scientists and engineers. So I interviewed 37 NASA scientists and engineers for the book. And yeah.
Awesome.
And you know, and every single interview was just wonderful. Everybody was excited to kind of tell me their behind the scenes stories of what it's like to work on these missions. And, you know, I was able to weave together the stories of these amazing people that I got to talk to into the stories of the missions.
And put a human face on a lot of these robotics.
Right, right. You know, these are all robotic spacecraft, so no people on board, that kind of thing. But, you know, behind every mission is a lot of human effort. And these people are, you know, they're amazing people to do what they do. And they know that they have very unique jobs that not a lot of people get to do. And so a lot of them do really, you know, a lot of them are on Twitter and Facebook, and they do like to share what they're doing. I think they were, again, they were very excited to talk to me and share their kind of behind the scenes stories of these missions.
I think that's a great tack that you took with the book, was that so much of what NASA does nowadays is robotics. And it's kind of a given. Jeff and I were speaking about this before the show, where you're going to be excited when someone goes into space, someone who will come back and you can physically talk to or you see on television shows and who is relatable and someone who can inspire and have other people think, wow, I could be just like them. That is easy compared to trying to get someone very excited for Curiosity or New Horizons going out to Pluto or whatever. Although there was a lot of enthusiasm generated behind it, it seems like the difficulty in stories like those is bridging the gap between explaining why this exploration is important and creating a human factor within it, which I think you did very well in your book.
Well, thanks. All the people that I talked to, they really exemplify how science is a human endeavor. You know, it takes humans to ask the questions that we want to answer with these missions. It takes humans to build the spacecraft and figure out the trajectories of how we're going to get these spacecraft to meet up with the various bodies in our solar system. And it takes the human mind to analyze the data. But, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be awed and amazed at the intrinsically beautiful images from space and wonder at the marvelous new findings from faraway places. I think that that kind of speaks for itself, all the amazing images. And I was so pleased that my publisher allowed me to use so many pictures from space. I got to use 240 different pictures in the book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, all of them, you know, from these missions.
I love that NASA has recently opened up their entire library of videos and images to the public for public use without any copyright restrictions or whatnot. I know we've taken advantage of a couple now. Those are mainly for social media posts and whatnot. But I have one on my background of a nebula on my computer that I just think is gorgeous. And you can just go out there and get them yourself. So if you as a listener are curious to go find out, or you're looking for some space artwork or just something cool that NASA's distributed, go on to NASA's website, check out their library of images and videos. It is something to just lose yourself in, rather than another listicle or 15 ways that Brad Pitt is better than whoever else.
That was a great article. I don't know.
So I have a cutting question, Nancy, and this might be a little divisive.
Oh, this is an important series.
So Sagan or Tyson? Carl Sagan or Neil deGrasse Tyson?
Oh, Sagan. Carl Sagan. Yep. I mean, I don't know. He was just so good at it and really did bring it down to a basic level that people could understand. And he was just so passionate about sharing that. Although I do love Neil deGrasse Tyson, too. I mean, he really speaks the language of the common man, too. So it's
right.
That really is a tough question, although I just love Carl Sagan. Reading Cosmos for me was a seminal moment in my life as far as really thinking, yeah, space is what we need to explore to figure out so many things about ourselves and about our planet and about, you know, just human qualities and the human species as well. So yeah, Cosmos was a huge book for me in my life.
I came home the other night and my wife was sitting on the couch and she had my copy of Cosmos out, and she was about halfway through it at that point. She'd been reading it while I was at work, and that made me very happy, I must say. And obviously, you can't have Tyson without Sagan. He's the progenitor. He did Cosmos first. Neil built on it, and he did a fantastic job, and I've rewatched it probably two or three times. But I think I'm going to have to agree and go with Sagan.
Yep. Yeah. It's both series were really good. But like you said, there wouldn't be the second one without the first one.
Of course not.
Just to be able to use the kind of graphics and technology that we have now, as mm-hmm. opposed to what was available in the 1980s. Isn't that when the first one came out? So
yeah.
So it's, you know, the ability to show, and of course the pictures and everything that we've received from all the spacecraft since then have just, you know, it's just amazing. The cameras that are available on these missions now are just spectacular.
See, I'm gonna have to go against the grain on you two, and say that I'm definitely in the Tyson camp, only because I first got interested in this whole space exploration astronomy. I ended up studying it in school. Is that in ninth grade English, I was required to take a reading class, like just a whole semester of reading books and doing reports and oral reports, and I was not really big into English as an elective I was forced into taking, and I realized I could get around this by reading only Neil deGrasse Tyson books the entire year. And that was just an author I discovered. Just went to a bookshelf, you know, went to the bookstore, picked up a book off the shelf, and it was
Death by Black Hole. I remember we were 15. I remember you introducing me to this book in the library,
and that was my start of, oh my goodness, this is what I'm going to be reading about for the rest of my life.
Yep. That's awesome.
What is your relationship with NASA? Like, how does that work? Do you hear from them? Do you go through you know some of your Universe Today or Seeker, or just tell me a little bit about what that relationship is like between you and NASA?
Well, it's definitely evolved over time, and I guess because I've been around for so long, they've you know, they know who I am, and they definitely I've actually had NASA people reach out and thank me for articles I've written and that kind of thing, which has been great. But yeah, in the beginning, you know, so Universe Today started in 1999, and I've been writing for them since 2004. And so, you know, the internet was still kind of just getting going at that time, you know.
Right.
It's changed so much over the years. And so, you know, when I first started writing, it was like, oh, you write for an internet site? Well, we're not sure we can, you know, get you an interview. Or
that's going nowhere fast.
Yeah, right. There's a stigma to it.
As far as, like, getting access to embargoed news, if you, when I first started writing, it was like, oh, well, you're blogging. Well, we're not sure we can give you access to this until the news is officially out. We can't give you a preview of it. So that's been a big change. But NASA's been really, I would say, supportive of bloggers and you know, especially they've really expanded their online presence. I mean, they're so amazing at their social media blitz and just sharing things. And I don't know exactly how it all happened, but they went from, you know, just allowing journalists access to launches and, you know, press conferences and that kind of thing. And now they invite people from social media to come and be part of this NASA social. It used to be called TweetUps, and then they...
That's cute.
Yeah. And so, you know, just the general public has been invited to come see launches and participate in press conferences. NASA's really showed people that they're, you know, they really want to involve the general public. And I think that's really great.
They're adopting more of an attitude along that Star Trek line where it's like, we need to have all of society changed by this scientific knowledge. They're doing a great job with the social media outreach, like you mentioned. I mean, they're inviting YouTubers and bloggers are now the people who wield some of their largest audiences, and they've recognized that and they've changed footing. So I got to give kudos to NASA for everything they do involving the public.
Yeah. You know, one of the missions that I wrote about in the book was this Solar Dynamics Observatory, and they decided to, and a lot of the missions, of course, almost all the missions now, they make their data publicly available almost as soon as it arrives to Earth. And then,
right.
And so for the Solar Dynamics Observatory, they created this website, and they, you know, they were one of the first people, first missions to do this, of just making all the data available and kind of encouraging people to take the data. I mean, Solar Dynamics Observatory is basically taking video of the sun, you know, 24 hours a day. And so you've got this massive amount of data, and the best way to use it is just to make it available. And so people have been making these videos, and when there'd be some sort of solar event, like a solar flare or sunspots, that kind of thing, and people would be making videos of these tremendous events on the sun, because they, you know, nobody had this kind of data before to work with. And there's right. There's almost too much data for the scientists to be watching it at all hours. So one of the scientists that I talked to, he's like, he woke up one morning and, you know, a user, you know, a person from the general public had made this amazing video of this solar flare that had just, or coronal mass ejection that had just happened on the sun. And it was like, whoa, they'd never seen anything like this. And, you know, they probably would have caught it, but it's like, what if the general public hadn't been watching this and seeing this come in? Is it possible the scientists could have missed it, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Wow.
So it's amazing how the general public has just become a part of the missions, it seems like, because I don't know if you've seen lately, so all the amazing pictures that are coming back from the Cassini mission, now that it's getting closer to Saturn, it's diving in between Saturn and its rings now, because the mission is coming to an end. And so they're taking some risks now that they wouldn't take earlier in the mission.
Right.
And so we've got these amazing pictures, close-up pictures of Saturn and the rings. Or the Juno mission is producing some incredible images of Jupiter. They're just absolutely stunning.
That's happening right now, right? Like the Juno mission is happening as we speak. That we're getting new data.
Actually, today, the day that we're recording this, it's going to be flying over the Great Red Spot quite closely. And so this will be our first real close-up look at the Great Red Spot. And anyway, so all this data is being made available as it comes in to Earth. And so all these people who are just kind of, what would you call them, image junkies, they take the data, take the raw data and process it into these incredible images that are just so beautiful and compelling. And, you know, I just can't wait to look at my Twitter feed in the morning to see what the latest images have been processed by just people from the general public.
I had no idea that this was going on, that the general public is just filtering through NASA data and creating their own media. Like, I had zero idea this was happening.
Oh, it's I can give you a list of several people to follow on Twitter or Instagram.
Yeah.
They're just amazing images. And in fact, the Juno spacecraft, the one at Jupiter right now, when they made their mission plan, what they wanted to do at Jupiter did not really require a camera, a visual, an optical camera. And it was like, well, if we're going to Jupiter, we really should, you know, take some pictures besides just, you know, using all this other data from the other wavelengths. And so they put this Juno cam on, and they decided to make it just a public camera so people can suggest places that that the camera should take pictures. And again, all the data is publicly available as soon as it gets to Earth. And you can go to the JunoCam website, and they're posting the images that are processed by the general public. And the scientists really aren't processing these images at all. This is a public camera. Yeah. And it's the level of detail in these images are something that we've never seen before at Jupiter. And the, you know, of course, the processing techniques are so much better now that just people from the general public can do it. You know, I mean, you do have to have some experience with some of the software, but it's the images have just been, I mean, you feel like you can fall into these eddies and streams of the gases in Jupiter's atmosphere. It's so, so beautiful.
I think NASA did a great job. You know, I feel I just am complimenting NASA constantly. I am wearing my NASA T-shirt as I'm speaking to you. I know you didn't see that before. But that's such an important factor in this this public outreach that we were discussing earlier, where it's definitely a lot more interesting to look at an actual color photo, even false color photo of Jupiter and its atmosphere, rather than a spectroscopy graph. So I'm glad they made that choice.
Nancy, I've noticed a new trend with NASA, and that they seem to be getting a little bit more on the hype train with their press releases. And I was hoping maybe you could give me some insight into this, but they're like doing pre-announcement announcements like, oh, come check us out on Friday because we're going to be announcing something about Europa. And this has become a more and more of a trend. And I'm wondering, like, is this some sort of public outreach? Like, have you noticed the same thing, that they're building hype on their hype nowadays?
I definitely have noticed that. So as I kind of mentioned earlier, you know, they would just kind of say, you know, we're going to have a press conference about, you know, Saturn. And well, now they'll say, come watch this about, we're going to be talking about, you know, possible life on your, what you know, possible environments for life. Yeah, just kind of throwing that out there. And of course, they're like, you know, submit your questions with hashtag Ask NASA. And they're definitely involving the public. And
as a new generation of NASA engineers and scientists come up through the ranks within the organization, I think we're going to begin to see a lot more of these social media outreach where when you're employing people who have grown up in a time where they're just naturally fluent in these forms of communication on the internet.
Oh, exactly. I agree 100%.
We hope that you're enjoying the interview so far. We have a giveaway today for our listeners. Nancy Atkinson was kind enough to gift a copy of her book to one of you. We decided that we are going to randomly pick a member from our Facebook fan page. So if you don't already like and follow the page, today is the day to do it. You'll be automatically entered into the contest. Just search for us on Facebook or go to facebook.com/cybersquidradio.
And on with the show. I guess with your book, I'm looking at the chapter list right now. What was your favorite one to write about? I mean, we have the Hubble Space Telescope. You just talked about Dawn, which is chapter 4, the hunting for extraterrestrial planets in chapter 5. What was your baby?
Oh, goodness. That is a really hard question.
I know. I know. Pick one of your favorite kids.
Yeah. I have to say, probably one of the most fun people to interview was Mark Raymond for the Dawn mission. He's just an amazing person, perhaps one of the most passionate persons I've ever met. He's passionate both about space exploration and life in general. He could go on and on about the virtues of a space exploration, of how this is a grand adventure of exploration that brings us together, you know, kind of this Star Trekian outlook on life. And, you know, he said things like, you know, who hasn't looked at the night sky in wonder? Who hasn't wanted to go over that next horizon and see what's beyond? And who doesn't long to know the universe? And so he said that, you know, anyone who's ever felt those feelings is a part of our mission. You know, we're doing this together. And he was just so fun to talk to, because kind of the Dawn mission kind of brings together science and science fiction all in one mission, because it uses this amazing propulsion called ion propulsion, which, you know, we hear about in Star Trek and of course Star Wars. The TIE fighters is a twin ion engine, is what TIE stands for.
Obviously.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't even know that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So and the Dawn spacecraft could be considered a single ion engine. And
a mono fighter, a my fighter?
Sci fighter, my fighter, whatever. So that was a fun chapter to write, because it kind of went, I kind of went back and forth between science and science fiction as far as explaining how the ion propulsion works, and how, and then of course, Mark Raymond and Carrie Bean are both big science fiction fans. And so they kind of went, even in the interviews that I did with them, they kind of went back and forth between science and science fiction to explain how the spacecraft works and all that. Another favorite was the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I've just always loved the high-rise camera, which is on board that mission. It's a high-resolution camera that takes pictures of Mars from orbit. And I got to talk to so many of the people who work kind of behind the scenes of the high-rise camera. And actually, I got to go see their operations center in Tucson. And
Oh, cool.
And it was, and I've said this before on other interviews, but to figure out the software and how to write the code for how do you tell the camera to take a picture of a certain location at a certain time using certain filters of your camera, and and the spacecraft is, speeding around Mars at, incredible speeds. And they, how do you do all that stuff and do it on a daily basis and send back all these incredible, incredible images of Mars? That's, and these pictures are being used by multiple missions. So like even they, NASA makes their data available to the European Space Agency and Japanese Space Agency, anybody who wants to send a mission to Mars, the Indian Space Agency, they just make their data available. If you want to go, like if you want to send a lander to Mars, they can do kind of reconnaissance of where are the best landing sites or spots, and what would be a dangerous place to land or what would be a good place to land. So it's, go see the high-rise images online. Again, they're freely available basically as soon as they get down to Earth, and they're just spectacular.
We will link to that in our show notes for you guys.
Well, how about this? Is there any like embarrassing or funny tale that you heard while interviewing scientists and engineers, whether it's in the book or not, something that maybe is a little tongue in cheek or somebody blundered?
We don't want you to throw anybody under the bus, but
yeah. I mean, this is a humorous thing, not like right. Somebody's career almost ended.
Okay. So, the mission to Pluto, so the New Horizons mission to Pluto was a mission that launched in 2006. And it was going to take 9 years to get out to 9.5 years to get out to Pluto. Anyway, there's this great story that one of the mission scientists told me, Hal Weaver, about the iconic mission of Pluto and its heart that we saw. One of the first images that was that we got back from the spacecraft as it approached Pluto. So, the spacecraft had they had lost communication with the spacecraft. Like 10 days before the flyby, because they...
After 9 years.
Yes, yeah. After 9 years.
So, oh, man.
So there was this tension of, not being in contact with the spacecraft for a short while, but still then they had, the spacecraft had gone into safe mode, and so they had to reestablish communications and upload the entire package of software that they had finally put together for the flyby of, when to take the pictures and when to slew the spacecraft this way or that way and all these kind of things. So we didn't, there was a period of time where we weren't, where it wasn't taking pictures. So we had this kind of window of time where we just saw Pluto as kind of a fuzzy blob. And then it went through this kind of 10-day period, or I guess it was about a week, where we weren't getting data back from the spacecraft because of that it had gone into safe mode. So they knew that they were going to be able to take this picture of Pluto, and it was going to be the final full image of Pluto before the spacecraft was too close to be able to get the entire planet into one picture. And right. so, and then, so it was, it was coming down the night before the flyby was going to start. And so they got this, they got the data. It came in like at about midnight. And so they had this group of image processors ready to like process this image, and they were going to make it available to the world at 6 a.m. in the morning. And so Hal Weaver is one of the mission scientists, one of the lead scientists for the mission, and he had the job of getting that data from the spacecraft, and he decided he was not going to look at it, that he wanted to see it with the rest of the world in the morning. And so he just got the data and he walked it down to the image processors and said, here you go. And then he was going to like try to go home and get a couple hours of sleep because uh-huh. he had been working. And so he was kind of sleep deprived. Well, the people working on it, they came down to his office and said, oh, this isn't it. You know, this is a picture of Sharon that we, you know, that we got last week. And so he had you know, copied the wrong data, the wrong piece of data. And so he said, okay, let's open this up together. And so they, you know, were gathered around his computer console, and they opened up this image, and here was Pluto and its heart, and that kind of heart-shaped flat area on Pluto. And he said, oh, wow. You know, they just like, oh, they were swearing and jumping up and down. And he dropped an F-bomb, and it ended up in print because there was a journalist there with them. And he said, I kind of feel bad about that. But yeah, so it was.
That made the journalist day, let me tell you. That was the best thing the journalist heard of that whole day.
Yeah. So yeah, it was.
Oh, but you know, it gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, it was. It was amazing to hear about those kind of stories.
That's so cool that you have to talk to the person who actually made it happen.
Yeah, the first eyes to see it. That was fun.
Do you have another book planned, and can you give us a hint?
I am currently talking to my publisher, who said that they would like to give me the opportunity to write another book. I made a suggestion, and they're not too excited about it. So, I'm open to any ideas. So, if you guys have a book idea that you think this book needs to be written, let me know, because right now I'm kind of at a loss.
I I'm going to throw one out right now. I'd really love a book that goes in depth on failed missions. Like failed missions from NASA,
like Project Orion.
Yeah, the Japan space shuttle launches. Like maybe even international, but like I'd really love an in-depth like human.
Yeah, let's not
element.
Pull NASA's pants down for a whole hour. Let's include ESA. And
yeah,
Japan
exactly. I want to see everyone's, because I think you learn from failure, you know, and you relate to that. And there could be a glimmer of hope, but I want a really dark science book.
Okay.
What came out of these failures? Like, how did this failure lead to this success? I think that'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did write about that a little bit in the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter chapter, because NASA had these series of kind of missions that failed in the 1990s. And, it was kind of bad news. There were people at NASA who, you know, some of them quit, some of them were fired. You know, it was the Mars Climate Orbiter and the Mars Polar Lander. They crashed within just a couple of years of each other. And, you know, things were pretty dark at that time as far as at JPL and you know, the future of Mars exploration. So they really have turned it around since then. There has not been a mission failure. And I think the people that I talked to kind of talked about how, you know, they were that era of faster, better, cheaper was not necessarily
not necessarily better.
Yeah, that approach was not necessarily the right way to do it. You know, one of the guys said, you know, we kind of maybe went off the side of the road a little bit, and of not being as careful as they are. And you know how NASA now has that kind of reputation of redundancy, and testing. And I think that they've really benefited from that approach instead of let's just get these missions out as quickly as possible. So they, yeah.
Well, if
yeah,
you
it's
did
definitely
end up...
faster and cheaper, but I didn't think it worked out for them. And I'd much rather have the reputation of, you know, double checking, crossing your T's and dotting your I's than
yeah.
killing people in space.
Yeah. So I definitely agree with you that you do learn from your failures, and you know that was a classic example. And so you know, failure is not all bad.
No, not at all.
Well, I think your publisher would love something like that, because then they could name it like "Top 10 Ways NASA Screwed the Pooch." You know, something like that. You know, just I'm buying that book if I see it on a bookshelf with that title.
All right, I'll let them know. And
yeah. Oh my gosh.
No, but that, yeah, that is an interesting idea. So I'll give that some thought.
Yeah, yeah. Nancy, is there anything specifically that you want to talk about that we might have left out? Because we've kind of reached the end of our questions that we have written out here.
Oh, let's see. Well, no, I just appreciate the chance to talk about my book and the people that I got to talk to too. So, but I think it's so a lot of people have told me that they didn't know about some of these missions, and they're just not hearing about these robotic missions as much as maybe a human mission, you know, the kind of coverage generates, the coverage that a human mission generates is different from the robotic missions. But, you know, we've got these robots out there that are doing amazing things, or, you know, flybys orbiting, crashing into and roving about on various worlds in the solar system. And, you know, previously we could only dream about these places and our artists could only imagine them. And now literally every day we receive postcards from these spacecraft, the images and the data from these faraway planets, moons, asteroids, comets. And, you know, again, these spacecraft really are changing our view of the cosmos, as my subtitle says. You know, as technology advances, we'll be able to do so much more. You know, who imagined when the first Viking landers landed on Mars in 1976 that we could have a rover going there and taking pictures that, you know, the camera mast on the Curiosity rover and the Opportunity rover are about 5 or 6 feet in the air. So those rovers are giving us a human perspective of standing on Mars.
Yep.
And the images that they're sending back are just so compelling. And it's just one of those, these are missions that are really saying, you know, come visit me, humans, you know, mm-hmm. because, we just live in an amazingly beautiful and breathtaking universe.
And I think you being able to shine a light with this book itself on the unmanned missions is extremely important, because while human spaceflight is what excites the most people and really touches something deep within us, from back when we said what was over at that next hill to what's across the ocean and now what is in the furthest depths of space, there will always be a precursor mission of a robotics crew going to that place first before we set foot on it. And that's why these are so important.
Right. I agree exactly that's what these missions are doing and accomplishing. They'll be the stepping stones to the future missions that I'll hopefully be able to write about in the future.
Yeah. And we look forward to everything that's going to be coming out of your little corner of the internet, and we will be watching closely. So thank you so much, Nancy, for coming on the show today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking to you both.
Jeff and I would like to thank you all for listening today.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this interview as much as we enjoyed participating in it.
We assume that if you are on this end of the podcast, you're one of the cadre of fans that really enjoy what Jeff and I are trying to do here, which is share science with the world.
I included a link in the show notes that makes it as easy as 2 clicks to drop a review into our iTunes page.
This really helps out our show, so thank you in advance. We'll see you here next time on CyberSquid Radio. Bum bum bum.
meow, meow.